Well, good morning, church. If you're a visitor here this morning, I want to welcome you. I'm a visitor too, and so I want to thank the church for inviting me. If you're a visitor, you have not come to church this morning. This is just an event the church does on the weekends. You've not come to a church, it's just a building that the church meets in on the weekends. You are the church. Do you believe that? And thank you for coming together this morning. This morning's presentation is entitled The Favor of God. And I want to give a little bit of background. Take your handouts with me. And for reasons that I hope will become clear, we're going to try to land at the healing power of forgiveness this morning. But we'll get there. A little bit of context. The original Hebrew story, if you need a handout, please raise your hand and we'll get you one. Those are being passed out presently. The original Hebrew narratives did not have heaven as the end goal. I know that may sound strange to many because today the majority of Christians view the end game as getting to where? Jesus died so that we could go to? That's what's taught. I would like to remind you that that belief is not the original Christian belief either. That actually didn't come into Christianity until the great first Christian heresy of Gnosticism, which we don't have time to get into that. But the Jesus movement was originally rooted and grounded in Judaism. And Judaism was not focused on getting to some far distant place away from here. The narratives of the Hebrew people was about heaven being brought back to earth, not getting a few away from here to heaven. For some encouragement, if this is a new thought for many of you, just consider what the end of the story is in Revelation 21, 22. Is God taking you home to spend eternity with Him in His place, or is He coming here to spend eternity with us on a renewed earth? Which one is it, there or here? So the end goal is not to become some disembodied soul floating around on some cloud somewhere. If you agree with that, say yes. The end goal for the Hebrew people and for the early Christians, the great Hebrew hope, was of a time when Yahweh's kingdom would be restored on planet Earth once again, where all injustice, all oppression, and all violence would be put to right, and they believed that this would be accomplished through the coming of the Messiah. Now, that developed over time into a paradigm in which we find Jesus stepping into in the first century. They believed that Yahweh's kingdom was going to be established in a very apocalyptic way, very similar to some people's interpretation of end-time events for Christians. God would return, He would restore Israel, and what would He do to all of Israel's enemies? He would destroy them all. And so they believed in a time where Messiah would come, and it would be God's favor upon the Jewish people, but God's vengeance on whom else? All the rest of the world. It doesn't sound much different from American westernized evangelical Christianity today, does it? I want to call into question this way of interpreting things based on Luke chapter 4. Jesus steps into this worldview, and it says He went to Nazareth where He had been brought up, and on the which day? The Sabbath day, He went into the synagogue as was His custom. Now, which chapter of Luke is this? This is Luke chapter 4. This is the very beginning of Luke's version of the Jesus story. At this time, I simply want you to notice that Jesus is still teaching in the synagogues. It will come very soon in all of the gospel stories where Jesus is no longer permitted to teach in the synagogues. And that's when we find Jesus moving into those open air spaces where He teaches outside. Just a little history. Unrolling it, it says, well, they gave Him the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. They handed it to Him. Unrolling it, He found the place where it is written. Now watch closely. The Spirit of the Lord is what? Because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the whom? You see, this is not about escaping this environment and getting to another one. This world is set up, and it doesn't matter whether you look at it politically, economically, or religiously, this world is set up in many forms upon a pyramid structure. Where is the majority of the people in a pyramid structure? Where do they fit? Where is the fewest amount of people allowed to be in that structure? At the top. And there's just enough freedom in this structure to allow enough people at the bottom to make it to the top to make everyone at the bottom believe it's still possible. But really, the whole structure is set up to benefit who? The people at the top, at the expense of who? The people at the bottom. Is that stepping on too many toes this morning? Is that a little too... Usually we like to talk about just getting to heaven, wouldn't we? Leave all of this stuff alone. There it is, raising its ugly head again. Jesus says, my first thing is I'm going to pronounce good news to which section of the pyramid? Those who are being oppressed. That's what the Beatitudes are, really. Blessed are you who are at the bottom of this world's pyramid structures. For this kingdom that I've come to establish on earth as it is in heaven is going to turn that upside down, and it's in your favor. You are going to be blessed. If you've mourned, you're going to weep. So he's come to announce good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim, what does it say? Freedom to the what? The prisoners. The recovery of sight for the... And to set the... What's that word? Oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's what? What I want you to notice is that Jesus is talking about changes taking place where? Right here. Now he says something. He says to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He actually, I believe, is misquoting Isaiah on purpose. I find great comfort in that, and I'll explain this in a moment as well. But if you go over to your grace section and read Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, Isaiah actually wrote, the Spirit of the Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. Everything's correct up to this point. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim freedom to the captives, release from darkness for the prisoners, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's what? Everything looks good so far, but Isaiah adds the phrase what? And the year of God's vengeance. Which part did Jesus intentionally leave off? This is a challenge to us today. I've been doing this for almost 2 decades now. Some of you were shocked last night afterwards to discover that I was old enough to be able to do that. I know I look young. It's that good, what do we call it? Whatever you want to call it. Yeah, making, keep it. No, it's not. It's just genetics. I'm really not that healthy of a person. I just have a baby face. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and we got married at 20. So you can do the math. I'm in my late 30s. Where was I going with all of that? Oh, I've been doing this for 2 decades. That's right. You can tell I'm getting older, can't you? Over those 2 decades, I've gotten a lot of emails from a lot of people who have felt very concerned about me and Renewed Heart Ministries of recent, feeling that we are imbalanced. And so I always write back and say, well, that, I want to be balanced. What area do you feel like? By the way, we're all imbalanced. How many would agree with that? Yeah, if you don't think you're imbalanced, that's imbalanced. I want to be balanced, so what area do you think? Well, they said, Herb, we feel like you and Renewed Heart Ministries, we feel like you overemphasize the favor of God too much for people. We never hear you talking about the vengeance of God. That used to bother me, because it's true. As I study the four Gospels and I try to present the topics and the passions that I feel Jesus was passionate about, what his topics were, I just never landed on the subject of vengeance. And then I discovered why one day. In Luke chapter 4, what Jesus is doing, and many people miss it, what Jesus is subtly doing in Luke chapter 4 is saying, I have come to announce simply the... favor of God. I'm going to be leaving off all of that vengeful God stuff. Now, this produces challenges for some of you in the room right now, because some of us want a vengeful God, do we not? Let's be honest. After all, someone's got to get even with those that have hurt us. We want a very punitive picture of God. a very retributive picture of God. Let's be honest, maybe not all of us, but many of us want a God who will assure us of his favor and assure us of his vengeance on our enemies. Am I right? That's where most of us land. And Jesus calls this into question. Now, remember, at this point, they don't understand what he's saying. It says here, if you continue on, let me show you. They didn't have a sweet clue what he was talking about. It says he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. He began saying to them, "Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Who is he claiming to be in that moment? Messiah. The anointed one who would bring this to fruition. And it says, all spoke how of him? All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. They said, is not this Joseph's son? And try to get the background of this. It's kind of like the hometown boy scoring the touchdown at the Friday night high school football game. Isn't that what's his name, son? What they're saying is, finally, Nazareth, this is one of ours. Nazareth is going to be put on the map. And are their feelings towards this positive or negative? Very positive at this point. But you see, they once again had misheard what Jesus said. Jesus had only announced that he'd come to proclaim God's what? What had he left out? God's vengeance. Now, once again, they didn't catch it either, because to them, they were two sides of the same coin. To them, these were associated. It's like if I play a word game with you this morning. If I say hot, what word do you think of? If I say up, what word do you think of? If I say Batman, who do you think of? Right. If I say peanut butter, what do you think of? Thank you so much for not saying mayonnaise. That's what the last group said. That's nasty. You see, this is the way it worked within Jesus' culture. When Jesus said, the year of God's favor, he didn't need to finish it. In their head, they heard, and the year of God's, they went together. But notice, as we follow Jesus' story, let's see if there's credence in the Jesus story for what I'm proposing this morning. Look at Luke 9, 5 through 7. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to who? Zacchaeus, come down. How? Immediately, I must stay at your house today. Now let's do some background to this. Jesus walks up to a tree, and it doesn't take the Son of God to realize something's going on in Zacchaeus' heart. If you were to walk up, if there was a parade, and you saw a guy in a three-piece suit climbing a tree, do you understand how out of place that is? To see you, would you consider there's a story here you need to find out if this person wants to see you that badly? You see, what had happened is Zacchaeus was a wee little... Yeah, you remember that. He was short. I identify with him a little bit. No pun intended. He had been at the parade at a previous spot. And where do the shortest people stand when a parade goes by? On the front. They don't climb trees. They get to the front. It's like when a family portrait is done. It's very challenging in my family because we're all short. People say, short people in the front. That's what the photographer always says. Short people in the front. We're all short. We all hurdle for the front, and there's no one left in the back. We don't know what to do. Imagine Zacchaeus trying to get to the front of the curb where the parade's going by. But every time he moves this way, the two people in front of him squeeze closer together to prevent his passing. He moves this way and they squeeze back this way to shut him out. Who was Zacchaeus? A tax collector. He was working with the Romans, the enemies, the us and the them. Do you see it? And what did they want on people like Zacchaeus when Messiah came? And what was Jesus showing him instead? And did they like it very much? Notice it says here, he came down at once, welcomed and gladly, and all the people saw this, and they began to what? They said, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. Now, two things. We read this in our language today. We read it backwards. We believe everybody's a sinner. Thanks to Paul, sinner is a universal term. That is not the way the Jewish people use the term sinner. Remember, this was a community, a little bit of history for you. This was a community to which certain promises had been made. If you agree with that, say yes. You did not earn being a part of that community by following the teachings of Moses. You simply demonstrated that you wanted to be a part of this community to whom the promises had been made by following the teachings of this community centered in Moses. A Jew was born into this community. They did not call Gentiles sinners. The term sinner was a unique term reserved for someone who was born a Jew, born into this community, but was living contrary to Torah. They were living contrary to the teachings of Moses. They were living contrary to the law, and therefore putting on display that even though they were born into this kingdom, they did not want to have a part of it. That's how they interpreted this. Now, I don't know that all of this went through Zacchaeus's head, but did they label him as living, as being a Jew, number one? Did they label him as living contrary to Torah, number two? And therefore, what did they call him? A sinner. Now, if you're Zacchaeus, put yourself in his sandals for a moment. He's shimmying down the tree. He's been wanting to meet this Jesus. Jesus just said he's coming to my house for lunch today. Zacchaeus wants to make a good first impression. And what are the people doing when they begin to mutter, this guy's a sinner? What are they doing to Zacchaeus' reputation in front of Jesus? It's almost like they're letting the cat out of the bag. I'm sure Zacchaeus will get to that at some point, what he does for work. Are you with me? But does he want that to be the first thing Jesus finds out about him? Does he want to put his best foot forward? And so he overhears them saying it. Jesus hears them saying it. And you've got to imagine Zacchaeus and Jesus standing there as these people are muttering, "This he's going to his house today? This guy's a sinner." You got to imagine all of the excitement of Zacchaeus that he's feeling in his heart. You've got to imagine water just being poured on that. And he collapses inside. Great. Now this guy's not going to want to come to my house at all. Because what was he expecting towards people like him when the Messiah did show up? Rejection and vengeance. And you got to imagine Jesus just reaching behind, putting his hand on Zacchaeus' shoulder, kind of squeezing it, so to speak, to, without words, communicate non-verbally, "Don't worry. I've got this." And he looks at the people in Zacchaeus' hearing and says, "The only thing I care about is whether or not his wife makes good lamb chops. Let's go have lunch." And how did the people respond to that? Positively or negatively? Negatively. Because what had he come to announce? The year of God's... Do we see him announcing God's favor to Zacchaeus and not his vengeance? Yes. And did it produce change in the heart of Zacchaeus? Absolutely. You can finish the story on your own. It's a beautiful story how healing was brought to Zacchaeus that day through encountering the favor of God rather than his vengeance. Matthew 9:10, while Jesus was having dinner at whose house? What was Matthew? Another sinner. He was a tax collector as well. But this time it's worse because Matthew is not just someone Jesus is going to his house to have dinner with. Jesus has welcomed a tax collector even to be one of his disciples. Now this is not just one of the 70. This is one of the 12. Do you get that? One of the, symbolizing the recreation of Israel through the 12 patriarchs, one of those 12 is a sinner. Do you understand how controversial that would have been? Jesus was a little bit more radical than what sometimes we give him credit for. He's going to the house of a tax collector. And notice also in Jesus' culture, whom you ate with was your tribe. If Matthew's throwing a party and he's inviting his friends, who are his friends? Who are going to come and eat with him? Other tax collectors, other sinners, other people who have been labeled by that religious community as living contrary to Torah. And when the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher what? Eat with tax collectors and sinners. What were they wanting them to experience from Messiah when he came? Favor or vengeance? What was Jesus showing them instead? And did this create problems? Yes. You see, we always love the message that God is love when we are the recipients. We wrestle with the message that God is love when those that have done damage to us are also those recipients. Am I right? In other words, I can be friends with you and you're cool with that. But the minute I'm friends with someone who has done you wrong, you have a problem with that, don't you? You say, why are you friends with them? I thought you were my friend. Isn't that how we work? This is very similar to the dynamic we have to see, we have to imagine is taking place in Jesus' day. In Luke 7, when the Pharisees who invited him saw this, he said to them, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a what? What did that mean? A Jew living contrary to Torah. What were they wanting her to experience from God? What was Jesus showing her instead? Favor. Do we see the story lining up with Luke 4? Look at it in Luke 15, 1 through 2. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. What we first have to notice in this passage is that Jesus had a kind of holiness that attracted sinners. They were drawn to him. The Pharisees had a kind of holiness that repelled sinners. If you agree with that, say yes. They steered clear of the Pharisees for fear of being what? Judged. And being judged, being condemned. Vengeance. I find it imperative that we allow this to confront us. Because to a large degree in our society today, when you think of Christianity in contemporary America, are sinners, those that we label sinners, are they being strangely attracted to us by the kind of holiness we possess? Or are they steering clear from us for fear of being judged and condemned? I can't answer that question for you. You've got to ask this question in light of the Jesus story. And to the degree that people are being repelled by our holiness rather than attracted by our holiness, to that degree, we have imbibed more the spirit of the Pharisees than we have the spirit of Christ. That is not the point of this morning's presentation, but it is a point within the presentation that we have to allow ourselves to be confronted by. How many would love to learn what it's like to be Jesus, to learn how to be like Jesus, where what we are actually attracts those that other religious groups have marginalized? How many would love to become that kind of a community? That's what it's about. Let's move forward. It says, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and does what? Now, this is in the Gospel of Luke. The Gospel of Luke is basically one meal after another. It's just Jesus eating here, then Jesus eating here, and Jesus eating here, and Jesus eating here, and Jesus eating here. And if you don't understand the context or the cultural setting, some people have thought that Luke had an eating disorder because all he ever does is show Jesus eating. But Luke is making a point. You see, whom you ate with was your tribe in that culture. And to show whom Jesus ate with shows, it backs up the claim in the beginning of Luke's gospel that Jesus had come to announce the year of God's period. He was going to be leaving off all of that vengeful God stuff. Jesus walked the earth as the radical, extravagant, and what some called dangerous favor of God. He practiced a boundary-pushing, Torah-challenging, line-crossing, Pharisee-infuriating table practice. And if you're being challenged by that this morning, you're in the right story. Are you hearing me? If you're a religious person being challenged by Jesus' radical, indiscriminate favor, if you're feeling uncomfortable by that,
And you're tempted to mutter to the person next to you, who is this guy and why did we invite him here? You're in the right story. Do you see it? Let's get back to Luke 4. Remember, they all spoke well of him. Because when Jesus said the year of God's favor, even though he left off the vengeful stuff, what did they hear in their head? Favor on us, vengeance on them. Jesus says, you don't understand. Jesus said to them, surely you're going to quote this proverb to me. Physician, heal what? You're sick. You need healed. You're going to turn on me. You're going to tell me, do here in your hometown what we have heard you did in Capernaum. Truly, I tell you, prophets are not accepted in their hometowns. Now, don't miss this. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time. When the sky was shut for 3.5 years, there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of the Israelite widows, but only to a widow in Zarephath in the region of where? Circle that word Sidon. Jesus is poking a sleeping dog here. You'll see it in a second. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in Elijah's time of Elisha the prophet. And yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the who? Circle that word, Syrian. Who were the Sidonians? Who were the Syrians? Just a couple hundred years previous, under the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, you can read about this in the Maccabees, Antiochus, in an endeavor to Hellenize his entire kingdom, had sought to lead a Holocaust against the Hebrew people. This is where you get the history of the Maccabean Revolt. How many know what I'm talking about when I talk about that? There were two brothers, sons of Matthias. When Matthias died, he said to his two sons, he said, remember the law of our God and wreak vengeance on our enemies. Judah, one of those two sons, took that so seriously that when he led the Maccabean revolts, the militaristic revolts of the Hebrew people against the Greeks, he earned the nickname, does anyone know what his nickname was? The Hammer. That's right, someone said it. This is the type of Messiah Israel was wanting to show up in Jesus' day. A Messiah that would come and use violence to overthrow and overcome the Romans. Not much different than what we're wanting today, is it? That's how we seek to establish kingdoms on this planet. We use violence. We participate in politics dependent on that violence. And even religiously, aren't we wanting God to come and restore his kingdom once again through a very violent interpretation of end time events, us and them, favor and vengeance? Whether that's true or not, you have to hold an intention with this. Jesus raises Sidon and Syria because the Seleucids, Antiochus Epiphanes, the Maccabees, that whole history. Do you know what the capital of the Seleucid Empire was? Sidon. When Rome referred to the Seleucid Empire, do you know what it called it? Just one word. Syria. When Jesus drops these two words in that synagogue on that day, what is he saying? He's saying, I've come to announce God's favor, yes, but not just on you. I've come to announce God's favor even on those Sidonians, the Seleucids also. I've come to announce the favor of God on how many? All, including your enemies. You're wanting God to create to come back and wreak vengeance on them. That's not what I've come to do. It would be the equivalent. We just passed through July 4th. And I want to be very sensitive because this is where you get yourself in trouble. This would be the equivalent of me standing up at a convention of veterans on July 4th. And going through the history of America and how God had preaching manifest destiny and how God had blessed America, which that's a whole nother sermon. You realize every time a Christian preaches manifest destiny, the Lamb is speaking like a dragon, calling the world to worship the beast. Do you get that? It would be like me saying how God has you, and then I finish this rousing presentation on America with the phrase, "And God bless America," and everybody in the room stands and applauds. Can you imagine that taking place? That's not too unbelievable, is it? And then with the same breath, I was to say, "And God bless Al-Qaeda too." What would happen in the room at that moment? It would be like me saying this morning that I've come to announce the favor of God on Israel, but on Hamas as well. Do you hear me this morning? What's the response? And the people in the synagogue, when they heard this, were what? Does that make sense to you right now, why they would be so furious? And it says they got up. They drove him out of town, took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. I'm submitting to you that if you've never been tempted to throw Jesus off the cliff, you've not yet met the right Jesus. Yes, Jesus comes announcing God's favor to you. How many are thankful for that? See, you thought this was what the sermon was going to be about this morning. And many of you are like, "Oh, good. We're going to hear about the favor of God." But God's favor is not partial. It is not just on you. It is on how many? And I know we are addicted to our exclusive clubs. But we're all the same. We're all children of the same divine parents, are we not? And God is coming to announce His favor. And we have to allow that to confront us. We cannot allow ourselves to be found in the position of the older brother. Do you remember that parable? We just read in Luke 15. Now the Pharisees were complaining that Jesus was showing favor to these sinners. And so Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son. And the story isn't about the prodigal son. You know that. It's not about the younger son. It's about the favor that the father showed the younger son and how it ticked off who? The oldest. He gets irate. He won't come in. The father goes out to plead with him that evening. And the story ends with the father and the son in the darkness pleading because the father is not going to change to meet what the older son is. The son must change to meet what the father is. Are you with me? And the brother's saying, "That son of yours." And the father's saying back, "No, that brother of yours. That brother of yours, whoever they are, God is calling you to look upon them as your brother and your sister." Do you see it? And what the parable tells us is that if any are lost in the end, if any are left in outer darkness, it will not be because they could not accept God's love for them. The older brother knew the father loved him. He accepted that, no problem. It will be because we cannot accept God's inclusion of those we feel should be excluded. That should cause us to sit up and take note. Do you understand why Jesus was crucified? Just a little. This kind of talk gets people in trouble. Trust me. Jesus wants to move us away from desiring for our enemies to be punished and desiring instead for our enemies to be restored. Do you believe that? People say, "Well, Herb, what about Hitler? What about Mussolini? What about you? I mean, really, do you deserve God's restoration more than them? Didn't Jesus die for everyone, didn't he?" Jesus wants to do a special work in our hearts this morning, where we stop desiring vengeance on our enemies and even those that have done us wrong. What we begin to see is that they're not our enemy. They're just being used by the real enemy. And God is wanting to awaken in us, it's part of our own healing, the desire to forgive and the desire to see them restored. You may not be the ones that restore them. If they are dangerous, if they are untrustworthy, then yes, you've got to have safe boundaries set up. Are you hearing me? Forgiveness is not forgetfulness. Are you with me? It doesn't mean they're trustworthy. What it means, though, is in your heart of hearts, you stop desiring God to get even with them for you, and you start desiring for God to heal them and restore them and return them back to God's image. And that is how many would love to be a part of a movement like that? Radically inclusive. Radically inclusive. Let me close with just a few more. Jonah, the Jonah story, it's in your gray section. We won't take the time to read it. But the Jonah story is clear. Jonah ends just like the older brother and the prodigal son. God, if I got to share the same planet with those Philistines, that's why I didn't want to come, God, because I knew you were merciful. I knew that if they repented, they would be restored, and then I would have to share this earth with them. If I've got to live on the same earth as those Philistines, he's saying, if I'm going to be saved alongside of them, God, kill me now. I would rather be dead than alive beside of them. Do you see what's happening? The parable of the wedding garment. How many know that story? How many does the guy end up inviting to the wedding feast? How many? Everybody. He doesn't lower the standard. He obliterates the standard. It's radical inclusivity. He allows how many in? And it doesn't matter whether you have something nice to wear. I'm providing the garments. So just show up, put on these nice clothes, and come enjoy the feast. And then a guy shows up, and what does he refuse to do? Why? It's not because he was rejecting the clothing. It's because when he looked around the room and saw who else was being included in this party, for him to put on the garment was not an acceptance of the garment. It was an acceptance of who? All of them. And he refused to wear it if they were going to be wearing it too. Do you see it? In other words, once he put on that garment, what he was saying virtually is that there's no difference between me and them. That they are just as much favored as I am. Over and over, Jesus would tell these parables. And over, it would cause those who are addicted to religious exclusivity and marginalizing sinners to feel uncomfortable, irate, and even furious. Think about it. How furious did they become that day? Homicidal rage. Do you see it? They were wanting to kill Jesus. On Netflix. Anybody here do Netflix? On Netflix, there's a documentary entitled Forgiving Dr. Mengele. It's the story of a woman by the name of Eva Moses Kaur. She has a very unique story in that she was a 10-year-old girl, Jewish girl, at Auschwitz. She was actually one of Dr. Mengele's twins. She had a twin sister, Miriam. If you know anything about Dr. Mengele, he was a very demented Nazi doctor who did science experiments on Jewish children who were twins because he believed he had a control group with the fact that they were twins. Eva was one of those twins. If you look at the day when the liberation forces liberated those at Auschwitz and you see a parade of Jewish people being let out, it's a famous black and white picture. But in the front of those pictures, you always see two little girls. Eva is the one on the left. In this story, in this documentary, she tells the story of how she was invited to the University of Boston. She's in her 80s now, but in her 50s, she was invited to the University of Boston to do a lecture to a group of medical students. A professor had called her up and said, listen, we know your story. We would like you to, you've been on the receiving end of the worst nightmare. You have been on the receiving end of the medical profession gone the most horribly wrong direction. Would you be willing to come and talk to our doctors, our medicals, our aspiring doctors at this seminar? She thought for a moment, and she's kind of feisty. You know how some 80-year-old women are. She said, I hate doctors. That's what she said. She said, I go to doctors, they tell me I'm fat. They tell me I don't exercise enough. They tell me everything I'm doing wrong. And then they expect me to pay them for this. She says, you're telling me I can come and tell them, all these doctors, everything they're doing wrong, and then have them pay me for it? She said, I'll be there. The person on the other end of the line said, there's one condition. Would you be willing to bring an SS doctor with you? She said, they're not exactly advertising in the yellow pages. Where do you expect me to find one? But she'd remembered that years earlier, in another documentary she'd been making with her sister Miriam, they had bumped into an SS doctor by the name of Dr. Munch. He was in Germany, and she thought she could still track him down. He wasn't hiding. So she got a hold of Dr. Munch, and Dr. Munch refused to go to Boston with her. There was no way he's going to out himself like that. He said, but I will, you can come to my house and interview me. And so she travels all the way over to Germany. She says when she stood on his doorstep, she said it took her just forever just to get over the anxiety of walking into this home. She finally goes into this home. She says during their dialogue, the servant kept bringing her pillow after pillow after pillow after pillow. Finally, she gets upset. Why do they keep bringing me pillows? Dr. Munch said, I'm so sorry. I just want to make sure you're comfortable. She says, when she gets done with all of her questions, she asks, there's one last question. Do you know anything about what was injected into myself and my sister? He says, I'm so sorry. All of those records were destroyed, and I wasn't part of that. He said, I have no idea. And then she says, out of nowhere, she just blurted out, what about the gas chambers? She said, the color left Dr. Munch's face when he said, that is the nightmare that I have to live with every day of my life. It was my job to look through the peephole, and when the last body was moving, I signed the mass death certificate. She said, it is one thing for a liberation soldier to say that there were gas chambers. It is quite another thing for a Jew to say there were gas chambers. With all of the reconstructionists out there, it would be very, very helpful if I actually had an SS doctor being willing to sign a document stating that the gas chambers existed. Would you be willing to come with me to Auschwitz next fall and sign a document saying that you saw them? He said, it is the least that I could do for you. So she travels back to the United States, and she's trying to come up with some way to thank Dr. Moon. She goes to the local Hallmark store. She says she stood in front of those cards for 2 hours, but nothing that Hallmark makes quite captures what an Auschwitz survivor would like to say to an SS doctor. After 2 hours, she goes home, and on the way home, she gets an epiphany. What would mean more to an SS doctor than a letter from a Jew stating that she forgave him? So she decides to write a letter of forgiveness to Dr. Munch. She contacts her old English professor, because her English is so broken, so it's very bad English. But she contacts her old English professor to have it edited, because she knows that it might be read in public. So the English professor edits it, gives it back to Eva, but holds on to it and she says, but there's one condition. Tonight when you go home, I want you to read this letter out loud. And every place that you say that you forgive Dr. Munch, whenever you mention Dr. Munch's name, I want you to insert into this document Dr. Mengele instead. She said, I can't do that. Her professor says, you don't have to mean it. Just say it out loud. We all have to start somewhere. Isn't that true? So she goes home that night. She says she stood in front of that letter for 30 minutes before she could begin to read it. But she says as she began to read and she began to say all of those things that she meant for Dr. Munch, she was now directing towards Dr. Mengele. She said when she said Dr. Mengele's name in that letter, she does not know how to explain it. She has no words for it. All she can say is that she genuinely and profoundly felt something inside of her change forever. She says, I was not delivered as a 10-year-old girl from the horrors of Auschwitz. She says, I was set free in my 50s on the day that I learned to forgive my enemies. So she gets a brilliant idea. She's going to invite all of her Jewish friends to this same event with Dr. Munch, but she's got a secret plan. This feels so good to forgive. She's not going to just write a letter to Dr. Munch. She's not going to write a letter to Dr. Mengele. She's going to write a letter to the entire Nazi party absolving the Nazis of all crimes against humanity. But she doesn't tell anyone. So she gets there. They go through the ceremonies. Dr. Munch signs his letter. Eva Moses Kaur presents her letter of forgiveness to Dr. Munch. And then before they go, Eva says, "But I have one more thing to present." She reads her letter absolving the Nazi party of all crimes against humanity. And what do you think her Jewish brothers and sisters in the audience that day felt? What kind of anger? How furious were they? Think about the story. Homicidal rage. There it is. They wanted to take little Eva to the brow of the hill and throw her off the cliff. Do you see it? Who's your enemy today? Can I just ask that? Who is it that God wants to do a miracle in your heart for? Her Jewish brothers and sisters said to her, "No, they need to repent first before you can forgive. They need to confess first before you can forgive. They need to do some act of restitution, something that says they're sorry." Eva says back to her, you can see it in the documentary, this is what won me to her story. Eva says back to them, "I was not delivered the day that I was set free from Auschwitz. I was set free the day that I forgave. And if I am left to wait upon them to apologize to me before I have the power to forgive them," she says, "I will be left their victim forever." She says, "I have the power to forgive whether they repent or not." And I would simply like to interject, does even God have that right? Now, don't misunderstand me. He wants to bring all of us to restoration and repentance. But sometimes we get that order backwards, don't we? I was giving this presentation about a year and a half ago in Wisconsin. At the end of my prayer, it was for the community, tons of people there that I didn't know. There was a little gentleman that walked up to me afterwards and he said, "I think I have a mutual friend with you." I said, "Oh really, who's that?" He said, "I'm actually close friends with Eva Moses Kaur. Would you like to meet her?" I said, "Is the Pope Catholic?" So April 4th of 2013, I traveled to Chicago, and I got to spend the entire day with Eva Moses Kaur. At the end of that day, after dialoguing with her and talking with her, I asked her, because I'm a dumb white American Christian, I asked this Jewish Holocaust survivor, "Do you think this is how God forgives?" So naive. She said, "I don't presume to know if there is a God or if this is how God, or anything about how God operates." She says, "I have lots of questions about a God." She says, "One day, if there is a God and I meet that God, he and I are going to have a debate over Auschwitz." We're all in process. Are you with me? And it is okay for a Holocaust survivor to say those things without a Christian critiquing it. Are you hearing me? But at the end of her presentation, she was giving a presentation to a Catholic high school that night, and at the end of her presentation, she said these words. She quoted Tikkun Olam, which is the Jewish phrase to heal the world. "God did not send his son into the world that the world might be condemned, but that the world through him might be healed." Do you remember that? So we covered last night. She uses the phrase Tikkun Olam, which is the Jewish phrase for healing the world. She says, "For the atrocities of the past, for them to not be repeated in the future, it requires more than just remembering those atrocities." She says, the memory of those atrocities must be coupled with forgiveness for those atrocities. And she says, "I met this little West Virginian today." She said, "He's traveling around trying to get people to forgive too." She says, "So I guess what Herb and I are trying to tell you, what we're calling you to become, is an ambassador for forgiveness, because this is the way to heal the world." In John's gospel, John says that God, again, did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. The Greek word there for saved, for those of you who weren't last night, is healed. What do we see Jesus doing but traveling from place to place, healing people? Are you with me? And it is not by accident that Luke's version of this world's healer, the restorer of the Hebrew hope when all injustice, violence, and oppression would be put to right. It is not by accident that Luke starts his gospel with a Jewish discourse one day in a synagogue by this Jesus saying, there is no favor and vengeance. It is God's favor on how many? And it's not God's vengeance on them that he's trying to accomplish. It is God's healing in you, where you don't have a problem with a God who should choose to include them too. We must learn to forgive. We must learn to see those that have hurt us differently. We must let go of the way of structuring this world in that tribalistic us versus them. We are all going to have to learn soon how to sit around the same family dinner table once again. The holidays are coming. Do you believe that? Amen. And the kingdom starts now. We are called to put on display what that world will look like today. How many would like to say, God, would you teach me? Would you just create in me even the desire for my enemies to be forgiven and healed? How many would like to say that, first of all? Because we're not there, but we can ask God to get us there. And second, how many of you would love to belong to a community that their first and foremost aspect of display that we're putting on to the world around us is no longer the vengeance of God on sinners, but the favor of God on sinners and inviting them to be a part of a world that looks like that. That's what it means to follow Jesus. How many would like to be a part of that? I know I said I was going to close a second ago. What's it mean when a preacher says he's about to close? Absolutely nothing. My last sentence, two sentences, three sentences. It's a run-on sentence. Jesus walked the earth as the radical, extravagant, and dangerous, enemy-embracing favor of God. He practiced a religious boundary-pushing, Torah-challenging, line-crossing, Pharisee-infuriating, radical table practice. And the only question we who claim to be followers of this Jesus have to ask is, do we? I'm reminded of the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, where he is endeavoring to move us away from demanding an eye for an eye and teeth for teeth, but to move into an area of loving and forgiving our enemies, blessing those who persecute us. Jesus used you, Father, in your example and how you caused the sun to shine on the just and the unjust and the rain to fall on the wicked and the good. And then Jesus looks at us and says, go and do likewise. Would you teach us, Father, this week, whatever it takes, whatever needs to be brought in or removed from our lives, would you teach us this next week how to love as indiscriminately as the sun shines and as indiscriminately as the rain falls? Father, may we be part of your kingdom restoration here on earth as it is in heaven. In your precious name we pray all this. Amen.